Hi everyone, I'm Manny, and you're listening to Bayan Bayou with Manny. This 7-episode podcast on anti-Asian hate, being Cambodian, and COVID-19 gives voice to Khmer 1.5 and second generations who are championing change in a time of racial divide in America. These stories showcase their unique journey of struggles and successes to make a difference in a country in which they call home. Today, I'm talking to Sukuntri Swai. She's a woman of many talents and accomplishments. To name a few, literary artist, author, musician, a PhD student, an adjunct English professor at Queen's College, and a Khmer cultural leader empowering the Cambodian diaspora. Raised in the Bronx, one of New York City's 5 boroughs, Sukuntri takes pride in being an urban Khmer 1.5 generation. Hi, Sukuntri. Welcome. Let's start with the Khmer 1.5 generation. What is that all about?
Well, the Khmer part obviously is in reference to the heritage, but the 1.5 has to do with the in-between generation between first generation, those who have newly arrived, and then second generation, those who are the children of those who were, you know, originally newly arrived. And 1.5 is for people who were born elsewhere but came of age in the United States. So that would be those who have arrived up until the age of 12. And it's a term that was coined by a sociologist. And so, and that it's not that old of a term, but I think its specificity is especially important when talking about Southeast Asian refugees.
Let's talk about your refugee experience. You were a child to refugee parents. You were born in a refugee camp in Thailand. How old were you when you arrived in the United States?
I was a year old when I arrived. So I was, I say that I was spared the things that my older brother had seen, what my parents had lived through. But that doesn't change how much I absorbed internally from watching my parents adjust and the fear, the not knowing. I think that is something that will always stay with me and that will always affect the way that I carry myself.
It's interesting that although you did not experience the hardship that your family experienced, it still affected you today. Let's go back to when you arrived in the United States. I believe you lived in a housing project. Take me back to that part of your life.
Let me just clarify that I spent the first decade of my life living in a rundown building on White Plains Road with other refugees, rat and roach infested, and that's where they had dropped us off. It was $5 and they left, and that was it. And then, you know, parents had to find their way. It wasn't until I was about, it wasn't until like the early 90s that we had left that building, which was not treating us very well. And a lot of the refugees had left. And we moved further west to what was public housing. And I don't think it was until I left the Bronx to go to school in Manhattan that I realized that the perception of the Bronx and people who live there and grow up there was a negative one. And that somehow the exceptionalism of me having gone to this particular school, like, well, you're from the Bronx. And if you're from the Bronx, then it can't be that bad, which was supposed to be a compliment. But I didn't take it that way. And now as someone who has who makes a home in Queens, which is another borough in New York City, I feel a strong affinity and very protective about the Bronx and the people who come from there and the people I grew up with and the realness and the way that it continues to get neglected while people appropriate, you know, hip hop and you know, Black culture. I like dreams, but I like the practical things too. 'Cause people got to eat.
Yeah. Speaking of people gotta eat, how did your parents support you or your family when they first arrived here?
I can't remember what my father did, but my father boasts, like, this is his story, and he has really wonderful sound bites. But he said, at the refugee camp, they said, where do you want to go? And he said, put me where they have jobs. And he has a real, sense of pride about that. And I respect that because, again, it's like, I'm thinking of an entire generation of people my parents' age in their 20s and 30s who have just, lost family, missed out on a good portion of their young adult life, didn't get to celebrate. And they come in, and, at this point, it's like they are stateless and homeless in the refugee camps. And so, what are we thinking about first? We need to make some money. We need to have a job. And I think I'm always going to remember that at the same time. I'm not dictated by the same circumstances. And it was kind of hard for, it was difficult for my parents to get out of that mindset. I think for like a good 15 to 20 years, it seemed like they were just surviving. And then at a certain point, my mother started having an excess of clothing. But then I remember she told me she only had one outfit, one school outfit for an entire month. And so you come from that, being raised as a rice farmer to here, it's like you can get all this surplus clothing. You get like, there's just how money works over here is so different. And I think about all the dreams that my mom is like, whatever they are, she doesn't really talk about them, but the way that they get lived out in the life that she has now.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, it's about purchasing power, right? If you have money to buy, then it's not about living the minimalist lifestyle. It's about what can I purchase with this money?
Yo,
Yeah.
what you just said is so real about first purchasing power. Oh, that sounds very like marketing.
Yeah.
But also what you were saying about the minimalism thing, which is such a classist thing, right? It's this idea that I don't need all this stuff and this less is more, but the less costs a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another world altogether. What's your earliest memory of becoming aware that you were different from people of other cultures?
I knew that I was different, but I wasn't alone in that difference. There were like seven or eight other Cambodians in that elementary school, which is like a really big deal anywhere outside of Lowell and Long Beach, the two largest Khmer populations in the United States. So I didn't feel quite as left out until, say, like when I went to high school in Manhattan and I was like the only Khmer. I think that's where it was more visible that the kind of Asian that I was not something that was known, and that having to explain myself. And then obviously there are incidents of people raise pulling their eyes and the ching chong and so forth. I mean, there was I for the longest time, like you knew that black people were different from white people and lighter skinned, but I think there was a point when I was little that I was like, oh my God, am I not white? Right? Because the way that we are raised to see ourselves, it's like, basing it on like skin color. I mean, it was a very like basic thing for me, as a child. And our parents didn't talk to us in the way that we saw on TV. I think it was like, so my name and then TV. TV was the great teacher and babysitter.
Coming up. Sukhunthri recalls her humble beginnings as a refugee in America.
And I was like, ah, oh, I'm a janitor's daughter. I'm the janitor's daughter sitting here, and I'm not wanted.
Yeah, let's go back a bit and touch on race. What racist experience had the most impact on you, and what about it that made the incident stand out?
As someone who looks like we do, there's no shortage of incidents to pick out. I will say that first, generally, a lot of the incidents that I had were like sort of the smaller catcalling things where, I was being sexualized and objectified. So, you know, first they'd start out very nice, you know, and want to talk to me and, you know, say nice things to me because, you know, I was a decent looking young woman. And then if I didn't respond back because I get bombarded by that and it's exhausting, then it becomes a bunch of racist comments. So if it was not sexism, it was racism. It was, and oftentimes they were combined. But actually the experience that I remember the most now is the one, it's more of like the long-term microaggression with white women.
Mm.
That is like, that's the one that like hurts really bad.
Hmm.
Can you elaborate on this experience and walk me through your feelings at the time?
When I became a mom, we had moved to an area that was, we were able to afford to rent a house. So we lived in an area that was a bit more well off with like one of the best schools. It wasn't until being there that I really saw how pervasive racism is, like more so like systemically, and the privilege that people feel about how much money they have and what access to resources they have and how they want to hoard those resources. That to me is one of the more like angering things that I have seen, because the incidents on the street, it's like, you know, people trying to get a rise out of you, but you know, it's not like they can take your money away. It's not like they can send you to jail. It's none of those things, right? In the area where I was living, which no love lost there, because I felt very trapped by it. Like, I'll tell you one example. I had a listserv for all the parents who in the area. And one person was saying something like, how dare these families put, you know, use the address, you know, of somebody else in our neighborhood to get their children into our school? It's a public school, mind you.
Mm.
So, you know, it was like the idea, how dare these, like, you know, parents from like poor, you know, backgrounds in like Jamaica, you know, black and brown families who like know somebody in the area and said, hey, can we put our address here so that we can send our child to this better school? How dare they, you know, how dare they? And the reason that this parent was citing is like, we pay all these taxes, you know, for our home here, and we should have, and I was furious. And like, that was like when it really hit me, like I have really left the Bronx. You know, I'm an educator, so everybody should have access to education. It shouldn't be segregated by how much you make, and therefore you can live in an area with better resources and a more active PTA. But never being said, it was just more in the way that I was treated or felt uncomfortable to talk about my background, because they didn't want to hear about the fact that I was a refugee, that I grew up in the projects, that I am discriminated against. It was like keeping it white as possible, keeping it as comfortable so that they are not shaken out of their privilege. And, you know, this bubble, because it was a bubble. They were living in this beautiful bubble. But, you know, because suddenly, you know, we were able to afford that, I got plunked into this area that made absolutely no sense to me. And it showed me that there is a really different way that people live in this country that keeps them from knowing all about people like me and like you. I don't know. It was so painful, because I was still trying to figure myself out as a grown up who had a young child, and not knowing how I wanted to be in this world, but I knew I wanted to be seen and acknowledged, and I felt really erased. And to me, like, that is the most painful kind of racist experience for me, because I as Cambodians, we experience that so much because, you know, people don't, you know, think of us when they hear the term Asian American, right? It's all the East Asians. It's all the, you know, the people who are, you know, international students, people who have been in this country for several generations and already have, you know, all the family and resources. And we are, you know, we came here because we had to. We didn't have a home or a state, a country to go to. Right. And also having different class issues as well, right, being put into areas of poverty. So, you know, we have more in common with, you know, Black and Latinx communities than we do with like East Asian communities, people who are toting, you know, education and Harvard. And like, when Asian American stories are like, oh, parents, my parents want me to go to Harvard, and it's just, I don't want to be a doctor or a lawyer. I was like, that's not my experience at all. You know what my parents said to me? They're like, my dream for you is that you get to sit all day at your job. My mom's on her feet for like 20 something years cleaning, you know, like 12 hotel rooms, including bathrooms, right? And sorry, I'm surprised at how much I get about this.
No, please, take your time.
And my father was a janitor, a porter at NYU. So, you know, he is that. They both had these jobs of invisibility. My mom was so tired once. Like she, you know, they were trying to get rid of all the women who had seniority, the workers who had seniority, because they were bringing new management and they could, you know, profit off of young people who, you know, would deal with being paid less. Whereas my mom was on salary and had been working at this hotel for the longest time. So they intentionally gave her more work and others too. So she was like, I have to have finished all these rooms and I don't have time to eat. So she would like, you know, eat her food in like a broom closet. And, you know, to be an adult and to be worried about your mom like that. And then my dad, I'm thinking about this incident that really like kind of hurt me. So my father worked at NYU, but he was hired by a company that worked at NYU. I would often go to meet him for coffee, you know, after I left home, like, and, the security guard was like, oh, yeah, you're here to see Chi. You know, you wait in the auditorium. There's an auditorium right next to his desk. And I sat there in the back, you know, to wait until my dad came out when he was done. And there were these NYU students who were standing on the stage. And I could hear that they were talking about me. They're like, who sent you? Like, who is that? Why is she sitting there? Who said she could sit there? You know, like they could have just come up to me and said, hey, this is kind of a closed rehearsal. You know, like that's all they needed to do. But they did that as though like I wouldn't hear in a small auditorium that was meant to create, like have sound, you know, move about. And I felt like, and I was like, ah, oh, I'm a janitor's daughter. I'm the janitor's daughter sitting here and I'm not wanted. And it's like, how dare you sit there? Who said that you could sit there? It was how I felt that day, and I was livid because I was just, you know, thinking about like the kind of erasure that my dad probably experienced too, as the guy who like operated their manual elevator, who was like cleaning the bathroom, and from anything that is Asian American, or but even more so on a larger level, to be erased as, you know, as people who have a particular kind of experience. Southeast Asian refugees in this country have a particular kind of experience that is different from, like, say, you know, Thai, from Filipinos.
You're right. The Southeast Asian community, especially the Khmer community, it's a different experience. We have gone through a background of war, genocide, fear, starvation, and being displaced people. So that's a lot to unpack right there. Let's talk about you as an educator. You're an adjunct English professor at Queen's College and you teach literature. What kind of literature do you teach?
Well, I'm a PhD student at the Graduate Center, which is part of the City University of New York, which is like the largest public university system in New York City. And I'm very proud to be a student three times with them. And so now I'm working my PhD, and part of that includes a teaching service, which is why I'm teaching at Queen's College. And initially you're enlisted to teach freshman composition, which is like the intro to college writing. But I was finally able to teach my first literature course this past semester, and it was a introduction to global literatures. So it was like literature from around the world, different backgrounds that were in English or translated into English. I mean, some of the things that we taught that I taught was Hajin, Octavia Butler, who's one of the most incredible sci-fi minds of the century, really, as she has passed away. But and also, she happens to be Black. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like, she's great. She is great. And she happens to be all those things. So for me, a lot of the anti-racist work that I do is within the classroom and within my own writing. And so with my students, I want to make sure that in the writing, there is a lot of Black representation, so that becomes a normalized thing, rather than it being like segregated and relegated to let's have a you know African-American literature course as an elective, as opposed to making it part of the curriculum that is required. So that's the kind of anti-racist work that I am trying to do, in addition to having narratives that are either about or by refugees and immigrants, queer authors. I would like to get more disabled authors in there. Those are the main differences. So when I talk about literary, I'm talking about either like sort of the classics or that's another thing that I want to expand. I'm not really into like sticking to genre. Like, I like to think that song lyrics are literature. You know, opera as, because I'm taking literature like literally as like text. If it has text, then I can take it and talk about it as literature.
Coming up, Sukhuntri reveals the message behind her writings.
Listen to me. See me. Or to my parents, I hear you. You don't think I'm listening, but I am. Or sometimes I have these questions. I don't understand what it means to be Khmer.
In addition to being a writer, you're also a poet. You wrote a collection of poetry called Apsara in New York, and it's a tribute to the Khmer American community. How did this project get started?
The poems in this book span over the course of 20 years. I started writing poetry more seriously when I was like 19. And then I got serious about it in my undergrad in college. But I had a bad experience at a poetry competition where this well-known poet, whose name I would not say, had said, you should consider writing in another genre. And so it was a tough experience, like something that felt very raw, my writing, to have it shut down by sort of a representation of the institution. Meanwhile, at the event itself, all these young women were coming up to me and seeing things that they had in common with my writing, like, oh, I love New York. And because everything I wrote was about being like a woman, being Cambodian, being a New Yorker, all those things were in there. So I stopped writing for a bit. And then after I had my daughter, I was like, okay, I need to be doing something that stimulates this mind, because I can't listen to baby talk all day. And I found writing again and got some things published. And then I saw something about a fellowship from Willow Books. And so I did the summer thing with them. And my writing was one of her picks. So, it was such an honor to feel that way. And so Willow Books had offered me, the chance to publish a book with them, which is so incredible. When somebody says like, hey, so we want to, we think we'd like to do a book with you if you're down. It's like, okay.
That was pretty validating.
Oh, that was beautiful. It was so beautiful because, it wasn't the goal. It was just the goal was to find my way. And the writing was just one way of getting there. So then the next problem was trying to find enough poems. So I had to go through a lot of like old poems, and I wrote some new stuff. And there are some poems in here that don't feel done. But truthfully, a book is never done. Writing is never done. It can always be revised.
Yeah, it's pretty true of everything. What message were you trying to convey in these poems?
Oh, there's so many. It's, listen to me, see me, or or to my parents, I hear you. You don't think I'm listening, but I am. Or sometimes I have these questions. I don't understand what it means to be Khmer. Or why is being Khmer so difficult? Or, you know, what is it that I want to remember of you all? What do I want to keep, you know, with me about being Khmer? And then lastly, after I had my daughter, it was like, what's my legacy? What do I want to pass on? And that is what drives me now. You know, I wake up every day and I know, like, I live for my community, for the Khmer diasporic community. And I want to leave something behind. I'm going to be leaving a lot of things behind because I can't sit still. I'm that sort of person. Because when I was starting out in 1999 and looking for books, I didn't see anybody who was Khmer except for people who were writing those survival narratives. And I wanted there to be so much more to us. And it's changed a lot. And I'm thrilled about that. But before it was like, I really felt alone and feeling like I guess I have to do this because I'm not seeing it.
Well, I'm really glad that you did something about it and that you were proactive in your passion. So that's awesome. When we spoke before this, you had agreed to read one of your poems. Which poem have you chosen to read to us today?
I just read this one for the Khmer Remembrance recently. But I feel like it's something that I want to leave us with. So it's the last poem in the book. It's called "Don't Let Your Heritage Be Past Tense." Think of your great-grandmother in woven silk, countless threads through her hands, weaving lines intersecting her face and palms, her children who compose your motherland fabric. Songsters of Cambodia's golden age, Rosrei Sutia Sin Si Samut Pingran, blare from past decades in static, singing across time through a rusty accordion. We have numerous words for eat. Si, nyam, hop, chan, bisa. Each bite is love. Ye asks if you're hungry, because it took 30 years to say I love you like an American. You imagine a future not yet past of grandfather's garden in Georgia, untended in the southern red clay where fruit trees have taken root. Someday you will taste dragon fruit on par with his on the streets of Phnom Penh. Da's face is bright when he sees you enjoy its flesh, studded with seeds. He says, I wish I could be here when the apple trees bloom.
Oh, wow. I had goosebumps listening to that. It's very touching. Thank you so much for sharing. That was beautiful.
That was something he actually said. So my dad was a rice farmer. So was my mom. And, you know, they had to bury their own child. Satya, my older brother, he died from malnourishment. And then when he moved down to Georgia and he had this huge garden, more like a farm now, and he grows everything. And all his produce and all his fruit comes from the back. And he grows hops. He makes beer and wine. He makes jam and pies and pancakes. Like, you know, he was like this all-American cook somehow. And he was like, I got this tree and the, you know, an apple tree and a peach tree and all these things. And then he said, you know, I wish I could be here to see them bloom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was like such a painful thought. Like, I don't want to think of a world without him in his garden. He'd survived a colon cancer, and one of my good friends told me that it's common for cancer survivors to like have gardens, you know, to be so close to death and to be nurturing and growing life. And he's so much healthier because of that garden.
Yeah, it's also therapeutic, right?
Exactly.
To watch something grow and to give life to it. You are one of the founding members of Cambodian American Literary Arts Association. This organization aims to unite Khmer diaspora writers. What else do you hope it will accomplish?
I mean, on the outset, that was, you know, what we had hoped for. And now, like, you know, I have stepped away from that, and it's being run by a beautiful group of people. I think the hope was, again, tackling the erasure by getting our community to think about how to express ourselves through writing. I and a few of the other founding members are writers. And so, you know, we saw something very strong in writing as a practice, as a way to keep from losing ourselves, to keep from losing our history, losing our minds, you know? So we wanted, and also that kind of speaks to the sort of issues with education within the Southeast Asian refugee community. I think according to like CRAC, Southeast Asian Resource Action Center, I think 13% of all Cambodians have actually gone on to college. Think about how small that number is. And, you know, as someone who has a master's in language and literacy, one of the things I learned is like reading to children when they are younger has a profound effect on their literacy capabilities because they are exposed to it. And so they're more likely to do that, to talk and to write more so that, you know, we don't end up being tokenized and only, you know, having like certain stories about survival so that we can have a vast array of stories. We can also just be regular people, that we don't have to be exceptional. You know, we fall in love and we have our hearts broken. People die in our lives too. Let's write about that, you know, put some donuts in it.
It's a vehicle to expressing ourselves.
One could argue that about many arts. We just happen to have chosen writing because writing, you know, writing's free.
Writing is free and writing is also very freeing and liberating. To many, you are a refugee success story. You are a perfect example of the model minority in America. What's your take on this label? Is it good, unrealistic, or damaging?
I'm groaning. I'm not anyone's model minority. So, you know, people can take that term and just, you know, get rid of it. I never want to see it again. I don't do these things. I don't do what I do to be good. Although I think from a survival standpoint, you know, for the longest time, my parents were like, you know, don't make noise. Keep your head down. Don't cause any trouble. Because they can get rid of you at any point. In fact, they're doing it now. Deporting Southeast Asians who came here as refugees. So it's like, there's a precarity in our position. We don't know. We're truly ever, you know, we're never really going to belong to some people in this country. I am concerned about like the refugee success story, that term, because it makes it seem like we are only as valuable as the successes that we have or make, and that, you know, there's this exceptionalism about us that makes us better, and that leads into the idea of the model minority, that, you know, we, and then therefore pits us against other disenfranchised communities and communities of color. Because if we are the good ones, what does that make black people or Latinx people or, you know, or indigenous folks?
So this label to you is damaging then?
I'm a bit troubled to have to say like that I'm somehow a successful refugee. I think that is something that like we really have to ponder that a bit. And, you know, like this is not the place for me to like think out loud about it, but it's not something I would call myself. It's, you know, labels in general are always going to be debatable. But for me, it's like I am an urban Khmer. I am Khmer from New York City. That is something I will take to my grave and be extremely proud of. And, you know, the refugee part of my family informs the work that I do, because I'm always trying to seek out narratives that will include us, which is what I do in my writing. But to identify as that, and that my success is related to that, you know, what does that mean for what? And what's wrong with just being like someone came here as a refugee? They just want to hang out with their family, you know, drink some beers and watch a football game. What's wrong with that? Why can't we normalize that? Why is it we can only be, you know, of interest or worth worth noting because we like brought these successes. Then we end up being like, I don't know, some kind of currency. It's like, ah, you see, we got these refugees. They're doing this stuff over here. Okay, that validates them.
No, I see where you're going. Yeah, I get that. Coming up, Sukundri says, you are Khmer enough as you are. It's in your blood.
It is something that is already in you. You were born Khmer, and that is an honor. And that is something that cannot be taken away from you.
Earlier, we spoke of surviving or your parents surviving in America. What pushed you to thrive in America?
Resisting. I've resisted my parents for the longest time. Resisted the role that they expected of me and the role that was placed upon my female body. You know, here's who you should marry. Don't marry these people. You should be washing dishes. Don't Riga watch the TV. Get home at this time. You can't talk to these people on the phone. This is the job that you should, you know, like having those expectations placed upon me, and me being already someone who was curious and, you know, fought back a lot. I learned to fight back, to resist those boundaries. So I knew that I lived within certain boundaries. So what I learned to do to survive was, how do I push those boundaries while still surviving and getting what it is that I need? So that was my hustle.
What is your biggest failure and what did you learn from it?
I have lots of disappointments and some regrets, but like failure, like to actually fail.
Maybe disappointment instead, because failure is a tough word. Some people, they don't look at failure as failure. They just look at it as a learning opportunity, right?
Exactly.
Okay, let's start from there. What has been your greatest learning opportunity so far?
I think, you know, when I think in general, well, two things. When I've auditioned or applied for something and didn't get it, every time that I did not get something, that I, you know, failed to get the thing that I wanted, I would cry and be really upset about it. And then I would turn around and figure out how I could come back stronger. Because for me, it was like, it keeps me humble. You got to stay humble. And like having those losses keeps you humble and reminds you that like there are amazing people out there in the world and, you know, way to come back at this and to be even better. How can I be a better version of myself? Mm-hmm. And then the other is, I'm always going to have regret about like the first couple of years of having my daughter. I had a postpartum depression, which was very, you know, which made the first year very dark. And, you know, I continued to have anxiety. And, you know, sometimes I just was not a great mother. And, you know, she was just this beautiful being who just wanted, you know, me to see her and to love her. And I hate thinking about those times that I was unkind. And that is something that I will always regret. But, you know, I see who she is now, and I see that, you know, I'm so much more than these tiny little incidents, but rather like she's become this incredible person, and that someday I can maybe let that go.
Yeah. I hope you realize at this moment that that was a real experience for you. And, you know, it's something that you had to go through, and I hope you didn't feel so alone going through it.
Thank you.
I want us to talk about what it's like to be Khmer and a Khmer woman in America. For me, I interpret the 1.5 Khmer generation as a hybrid of two cultures, Khmer and American. Living in these two worlds is also something I can relate to. Now, if someone was to say to you, you're not representative of a Khmer woman because you're too bold, or you're not Khmer enough, how would you respond to that?
Oh, great question. I love this question. Yeah. And this is something that I've been trying to like tell the younger diaspora community, and that is like there's no one way to be Khmer. If that were the case, then it'll be like somebody who it would be like a woman who is passive and does everything that her husband expects, and she speaks, you know, flawless Cambodian and makes amazing food and never complains.
Yes.
So I'm really not interested in if that is the representation, the old fashioned, outdated one that people are looking for, they can go elsewhere. I am interested in, I want to hear Cambodian women get angry, like angry Asian women. Like that's a thing that we don't get to hear because, you know, as a therapist says, anger is a clarifying emotion. Mm. And, you know, like people fear an angry woman. And why is that? What can an angry woman do to this world?
You know, anger is not a bad word. I have to tell you, I am most articulate when I'm angry. And my husband will tell you that my English is perfect when I'm angry. So I get that. I get what you're trying to say. Yeah.
Oh, no. Do you know I'm so powerful? I am when I am angry. And yeah, no, it's because like I know what it is I'm trying to say, because so often I'm held back by the culture, by the various cultures that say that we're not supposed to be that way. And so like for me, the power I get is as a Khmer woman is being able to voice all those things, to voice all the desires, the dreams, the anger, the disappointment, regret, that full spectrum of emotions that I and many other Khmer women otherwise were not allowed to explore and to express.
Here's the $1 million question I have for you. What does it mean to be Khmer? Is it the food you eat, your circle of friends, your understanding of the nation's history, the cultural norms you practice, or is it simply having pride and embracing your country of origin? What does it mean to be Khmer to you?
It's definitely more about like the latter. I want to say to all my Khmer siblings that growing up, you've made to feel like somehow that you're not Khmer enough, that there's a certain way to be Khmer. And I want to say that that's complete bull. And that you don't need to speak the language perfectly, flawlessly to be Khmer. You don't need to know all the practices. You don't need to know how to do all the Pali chanting or cook all the dishes, you know, that are Khmer, or, you know, or do all the right gestures. It is something that is already in you. You were born Khmer, and that is an honor. And that is something that cannot be taken away from you. This gorgeous thing that you don't have to prove.
Mm, right. Just be.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. You know, yeah. That's what my siblings need to know right now. And that's what I'm trying. That's what I try to do in my work when I have to represent as Khmer, which is like a lot of it is just deprogramming them and just to say like, you're okay if you don't speak Khmer.
Yeah, take the pressure off of asking yourself, you know, am I good enough or am I Khmer enough? And just be, right? Because I'm a product of many things.
Yes, all yes, right. Yes. Beautiful.
Okay. What haven't I asked you that I should have?
I don't know. I could talk all day. If you ask me questions, I could talk all day because it's just so fun, you know? It's so fun to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Last question. What do you want to be remembered for?
I want to be remembered as someone advocated for the culture and arts of the Khmer diaspora and who loved and uplifted and comforted the younger generation. Yeah. It's like the sign that I saw. It said, you know, only when we serve can we truly be free. And, you know, I told my daughter once, I said, Soya, you know, all we have is each other. We have to be there for other people in this world. That's how we survive. We care for each other. And it's not limited to just Cambodians either.
So here's my conclusion. And here's what I know. You are eclectic, passionate, and unapologetic about who you are and what you stand for. I'm very happy to speak to a strong Khmer woman today. my takeaway from our conversation today is that it's only when we really know who we are that we can share more of ourselves with others. So thank you so much, Sukundari, for sharing your story with us. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was really like uplifting.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoy listening to my guest's journey from surviving to thriving as Khmer in America, and for the lessons they have learned and shared with us. For more stories like this, visit us at voacambodia.com. Until next time, I'm Manny, your host of Bayan Bayou with Manny.